I decided to use the seven sectors of enlightenment for this course. They lend themselves very well to prolonged talks and discussions, and we do have many days that we can discuss them. But not only that, by their name you can tell that they are seven things which one has to practice if one wants to go the Buddha's path. Now, the Buddha's path is a path to enlightenment. There is nothing else. Whatever else we do is only a means for that particular end. There was an article in a German newspaper, because Buddhism is a media affair in Germany at the moment, and it was entitled Meditating More Beautifully, and it was a satire, quite rightly so. It was quite well seen by that journalist, because that's not what it's all about. Of course we have to meditate. Of course we have to be successful at the meditation. But they're all means to an end. And the only end that the Buddha had in mind was what is called enlightenment, nirvana, what you can call liberation, freedom, perfection. You can use any word you like, it doesn't matter. This is another thing that is important also, that one doesn't get hung up on words. Words are the fingers that are pointing to the moon, but they're not the moon itself. And people make that mistake all the time. Creation and creator and God and an old man and sitting there and nirvana and nirvana and soul and paradise and heaven and God knows what else. These are all concepts. And if you happen to speak English, that's the ones you use. If you speak a different language, you use different concepts, because they're not exactly the same always in translation. And the thing to do is, with words, to treat them exactly as I say. They are guidelines. Buddha used words, thousands of them, in order to tell what to do. But very often, they're also misunderstood. Very often. And they're described and explained in a manner, in a way, which is useless. And people who misunderstand them are usually enormously sure that they have understood them and argue no end. But what you need to do with the words is to look at and see, what does it mean for me? How can I deal with that? How do I relate to that? Now here's a word, enlightenment. How do I relate to that? Well, the most useful answer is probably, I don't relate to it at all. I don't know what it is. That's right. But then maybe the next answer would be, sounds all right. Maybe I should try. Mm-hmm. And a third answer might be, well, if that's what the Buddha had in mind, and if I really want to use this pathway, or maybe I should take it for granted that that is the pathway I'm treading. All these are possibilities. The mind can also say, enlightenment, who needs enlightenment? I just want to be a little happier. That's fine too. But what one needs to do is not try to argue or try to make something out of the word, but if it has some meaning, to see what the personal meaning is. What does it mean to me personally? One enlightened person changes the whole world. And one peaceful person changes the whole world. And there's no question about it. One can feel it and see it and be part of it. See, it's very easy also for us to become aware of that. Somebody is very angry. we know exactly what they're doing. We've all been there. We've all been angry. So we can tell, oh, person is angry. And if we don't fall into the trap of getting angry too, we might have compassion for that person, that they're so angry. But somebody comes in and is enlightened, how would we know? We've never been enlightened, so what do we know about it? What does it feel like? It doesn't wear a halo, hasn't got a badge on, nothing. So we know exactly what we've got inside of us. That's it. That's all we know. And that's why it is so important to enlarge upon that what we have inside us, so that there's more that we can grasp. We can listen, we can hear, we can read, we can do all sorts of things. And there are innumerable seminars and courses and people advertising enlightenment. I've seen that advertised too, enlightenment. Amazing, absolutely amazing. Yes, it's a real advertisement, isn't it? I think you might have seen it too, I think. And actually, it's very funny, I must say that. I get a real kick out of this sort of thing. I was sent a little pamphlet, or more than a pamphlet, was maybe an article by the man who's advertising enlightenment. And he didn't send it, somebody else sent it to me. And the way he talks about it and everything, and what to do and how to do it, and claims, quite obviously, that he has thought about all this by himself. Now, what he says in that article is totally correct. It's perfectly all right. And it's exactly according to the Buddha. But he's never heard of the Buddha, apparently. And thinks he thought it up by himself. So all he needs is a little more time. He's still pretty young. And a little more time to find out that it's all been there. Has been here forever. It's not only this one Buddha. This one Buddha that we are referring to, that's 2,500 years ago. But in our tradition, he was the seventh Buddha. And Buddhas always arise and help mankind in some way. So I found this most interesting, that there is a person who has come to all these ideas, what to do and how to do it, and calls it enlightenment, and thinking he's done it all by himself, and actually it's in very perfect agreement with what the Buddha teaches. But Buddhism, of course, has no place in his explanation. So this proves to me that we are all connected, and we are connected to universal consciousness. There's just no doubt about it. And we can get out of universal consciousness like an echo, that what we already have in here. So if we've got plenty of anger and worry or upset or dislike in there, well, that's what we're going to get out of universal consciousness. There's plenty of that in there. It comes there from all sides. But if we have purity and the wish for enlightenment, liberation, for freedom, the understanding of dukkha, then some of that, what is in universal consciousness, will also come to us. It's like an echo. And none of us, and certainly not somebody who's teaching, and the one that I was referring to, are separate entities able to think all this up ourselves. Nobody is. It's never happened before, it never will. The only one that is said to have to think it up by himself is a new Buddha. And a new Buddha only arises when Buddhism has died out. And then the new Buddha has to think up the whole Four Noble Truths and the whole path again by himself, because there's no teacher there. But other than that, there's total connection. And this is an important aspect, I think, that we should never forget. Quantum physics tells us that. Of course, we don't pay any attention to that sort of thing. Who needs quantum physics during the day? But it's actually something which is very important. There are no observers. There are only participants. The observer changes the observed. So very interesting. I was never interested in that sort of thing. I mean, physics, I didn't even understand the bare minimum in school. It just didn't interest me. But that is becoming interesting, because it's exactly what the Buddha said. Unity consciousness. It's always there. Now remember that too, for the purpose of this retreat. We're all influencing each other. And that what we get out of a retreat and what we get out of a teaching is 90% that what resides in the teacher, and 10% are the words. So never get hung up in the words. It's important to ask, what does that mean? Most of the Buddha's discourses are answers to such questions, like the one I was mentioning yesterday, where I finished the book called the Potapada Sutta. It's a man called Potapada, and he asked question after question. And if he hadn't done so, we wouldn't have the whole explanation of higher states of consciousness. He was totally hung up on higher states of consciousness and absolutely had to know what it meant, and also wanted to know what's the self and why isn't it and where is it and how is it. And the Buddha very patiently answered and answered and answered. So it's important to ask. But it's important to ask, and this is also, I think, a point which in every retreat practically everybody does come to. To ask so that it's meaningful for myself. What's that mean to me? Maybe it would be a question that somebody else would put in a totally different way. That's fine. No problem. But what does it mean to me? And that's an important way to ask questions. And if one has taught as long as I have, I can tell whether it's meaningful or not, just from the way it's worded. Sometimes questions are asked which are the answers are not even meaningful to that person. And you know what the Buddha used to do with those questions? He either asked a counter question or he kept silent. He wouldn't say anything, because he could see it wasn't going to be. He tells this to Potapada, actually. This is not conducive to Dhamma. This is not conducive to enlightenment. And this is what I actually started out with. The whole teaching is supposed to be conducive to enlightenment. And enlightenment means the end of all dukkha. Now people have, of course, misunderstood this, to think of it as if it were paradise, you know, utopia, heaven. Well, it can't be heaven. Anybody who's ever been in a jet plane knows that that's just clouds. I mean, there's nothing there. It's totally uninteresting. It's just clouds up there. So it's not none of those things. It's the end of dukkha, because there's nobody there to have dukkha. It's as simple as that. The simplicity of that does not denote that it's simple to do. It's the most difficult thing that we can do in this lifetime, but it's also the most rewarding. There's nothing that compares with the reward of not being there. Imagine. Well, can you? One should, actually. One should be able to imagine it. I compare that to an architect who has an idea how to build a house. So what does he do? He imagines this house and puts it on a piece of paper. And then he can give it to some builder to say, well, look, this is the way I want it, now you do it. Well, this imagination of making a blueprint is very important also in the Dhamma. We shouldn't just say, ah, yes, Nibbana, well, somewhere where I don't know, or not understood, or which is true. But we should actually use our mind with as much fertility as it may have to imagine what it could be like to be without that feeling of there's me. If we have been able to do the higher jhanas, actually starting from the fourth, particularly in the fifth and sixth and seventh, we get an inkling of it. Now these jhanas are also part of the factors of enlightenment, and we'll talk about them. But if you get an inkling of it, it's much easier to imagine, of course. But if you don't have an inkling of it, there are some very worldly and mundane situations which also point in that direction, what it's like to be without this me, even though it is very short-lived and very momentary. It doesn't matter, even in one moment. Let's say that we have been watching a sunset, or we've been at the ocean, becoming really imbued and interested and concentrated on the wave movement. Or we've been watching a small child, which is very cute and delightful. And we have felt a great sense of happiness in that situation. Now let's take a sunset, which is totally neutral and impersonal. Now obviously, the result of our thinking then is, it's due to the sunset. And we must go and watch more sunsets. And so we do, and the next sunset isn't quite as good. And maybe it's even just as beautiful, but we don't feel this great sense of happiness. So we decide, well, maybe it's not the sunset. Maybe it's the ocean. So we'll try that. And the same thing happens over and over again. But what actually is happening there, it's got nothing to do with the sunset, it's got nothing to do with the ocean, has absolutely nothing to do with the small child. These are triggers. Triggers that trigger us into a moment of self-forgetfulness. And when we are triggered into a moment of self-forgetfulness, we can totally give ourselves to the experience. And as we give ourselves totally, even very, very momentary, totally give ourselves to that experience, we have a great sense of delight. And that delight lives within us. It's not there because of the sunset. Because we have seen how many sunsets? Hundreds. Hundreds of sunsets. And if we were, for instance, engaged in driving a car while the sunset was there, we weren't delighted. We said, oh, isn't that pretty? Look over there. And that's it, finished. But that inner, complete feeling of, actually, there's nothing but sunset. There's nothing but beauty at that time. That is only brought about by that self-forgetfulness. So that, even without being able to do any of the higher jhanas, may give an inkling what it can be like when self is no longer the motivating factor. Now, in the world, in humanity, but also in animals, in fact, in all manifestation which is not enlightened, which are many different manifestations, self is the motivating factor. The stronger the self, the more it motivates us, and the more problems we have. If we have few problems, then the self isn't very, not very enlarged. If we have a lot of problems with our surroundings, with the people that we deal with, if we'd rather not deal with them, but like to sort of remove ourselves from them, the self is having a lot of problems. I like to compare that with a very fat person trying to go through a narrow door. If that very fat person goes through the fairly narrow door, they bump the body at each side of the door frame, and it hurts. But if a slim person goes through there, they don't feel a thing. So if the ego is very fat, it gets bruised all the time. Constant problem. And it doesn't need any other person to create the problem. The ego creates its own problem. But if the ego has already slimmed down, then it can easily sort of move in and out of all our confrontations. But being able to imagine what it's like to be without it is a help. The same as it is a help to be able to imagine what it would be like to be concentrated. What the mind conjures up, it can eventually do. We don't have to sit here and wait for the luck or the chance, luck of the draw or the chances that we get. We can make them happen. And this is what the Buddha said. Make it happen. Know what is important and make it happen. And obviously we all have a good enough karma to make it happen. Otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here. People who have very bad karma, they don't come to meditation courses. And if they too do come, which is rare, they usually run away after a short time because their whole being is not geared towards this sort of thing. So we have been good enough karma. And trying to conjure up what I really want to do doesn't mean that I'm now imagining I'm doing it. Remember the simile of an architect with a blueprint. He's made the blueprint. He doesn't imagine he's already built the house. I mean, the house is nowhere to be seen. But he knows exactly the way it should look. And also he can explain how it should look. So it's a big difference between the blueprint and the actual house. But it's very difficult to build a house without a blueprint. It's sort of potluck. And it can very easily happen that things go haywire when you do. You have to be very careful. You have to really know how you want to do it. So same goes here. There are 37 factors of enlightenment, and within those 37 factors, the seven are, again, one of them. But the seven factors of enlightenment are more often enumerated by the Buddha than the 37 factors. The seven factors of enlightenment are mentioned quite a number of times, not necessarily with that name. He mentions them over and over again as steps to practice. And as usual, and practically always, it starts out with mindfulness. There's no way we can do anything if we aren't mindful. Now, the word mindfulness is also constantly misunderstood, and we are misled by its simple way of sounding. I mean, what could be difficult about being mindful? Well, actually, it's not easy at all. And mindfulness starts always with mindfulness of the body. That's how it always starts. And in the meditation, we use the breath as mindfulness of the body, and the walking meditation as mindfulness of the body. These are two of the most traditional ways of using mindfulness in meditation. The attention to the breath in Pali is anapanasati. Sati is mindfulness, S-A-T-I. And anapana is in breath, out breath. So what we're actually practicing when we're watching the process, we're practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, which is the first foundation of mindfulness. And we could enlarge that mindfulness of the body by thinking of being mindful of materiality, of material things which surround us. But being mindful means to be aware and awake, and being very keen observer. And a keen observer eventually gets a different view of what he or she observes. Having really observed, we see it differently. Now, when we observe our breath, and we know we can't live without it, we never think of that, of course. We just say, oh yes, it's a meditation subject, okay. And if we get asthma, it's something which is very unpleasant, because we can't breathe properly. Or if we should be drowning, that's also very unpleasant, because we don't get any breath. But other than that, we never think of the breath. So now we've got it as a meditation subject. But what do we think about it? Maybe we think, I can't concentrate. Oh, now I concentrated. Oh, my breath is going too fast, I should slow it down. Or, it's too hot to meditate. Or, any number of things. But none of them are on the way to liberation. None of these thoughts. Whether we can concentrate or not, or whether it's hot or not, it's got nothing to do with the pathway that the Buddha taught. When we actually watch the breath, the first thing that should come to mind is, if the mind doesn't immediately become calm, is that our life depends on it. Second thing is, it depends on a completely impermanent intake and outgo of a little bit of air. And if that air should not be pure enough to live in, we die. Which has happened when atomic installations blow up and things like that, and people all over the place die, or bombs go off. So we are dependent upon a little bit of air going in and out. Now immediately it's apparent that everybody else is too. There's no difference. They want the same air, and they want equally as much of it as we do. And it should be given equally as much, otherwise they can't continue to live. So where's the difference? Then, when we see this impermanent bit of air going in and out, we can very often relate to the rest of the body as also not being as solid as we thought it was. It's also moving all the time. Maybe we can feel our heart beating. Maybe we can feel our blood pulsing. Maybe we can actually even feel the tiny movements that are ourselves, but they wouldn't say, I am a cell. It would just be a tiny movement which happens, and we could feel that. And as we feel all that, we lose some of that solidity feeling. Now, mindfulness of the body is the first foundation of mindfulness, and because the Buddha thought and said it was so important, he urges us to always return to it. Not only in the meditation, but outside of the meditation. And this is also the reason why I'm using it as a very first item. So that, outside of your meditation, when you, for instance, come from your room to the meditation hall, or from the meditation hall, you go to the dining room, or you put on your shoes, or you take off your shoes, or you get dressed, or you get undressed, or you take a shower, whatever it is you're doing, you have keen observation of every movement. Now, what does that do? It does many things. The first thing it does, it purifies. The one way for the purification of beings is the first line of the mindfulness explanation of the Buddha. The one way for the purification of beings. Why does it purify? Because if one is a keen observer of every movement one makes, one could not possibly have any hate or greed in the mind. It can't do two things in the mind at once, which is a great boon to us. Although the mind is so fast that we can, of course, change all the time. But if we, through the meditative practice, have had some concentration ability, we can stay on the movement, and we can actually recognize the intention behind it. I'm now going to put my shoes on. And then the extra putting on of the shoe. And as we do that, the mind is clear and translucent and pure. It has nothing that it can be worried about. There's nothing to worry about putting on some shoes. Nothing at all. Neither is there anything to worry about when you take a shower or when you get dressed or undressed. But what we do instead of being a keen observer of what we're doing, we are maybe putting on our shoes and debating in the mind whether the meditation we've just had was good or bad, or whether we should actually do it this way or that way, and how we could make it better, or how we could remove ourselves from the heat, or how we could solve some personal problem, instead of putting on shoes. Naturally, there's no purification and there's no mindfulness. Everybody does it. The thing to do is to become aware of it. It's really fascinating. We call the mind a magician. It pulls magic, everything, even out of putting on shoes. It's somewhere entirely different. It doesn't have any connection to putting on shoes. It's too easy to put on shoes. And then we walk. We walk, we put on our shoes, we walk to the dining room. Well, since we learned walking when we were less than 2 years old, of course we are very adept at it. So, who pays attention to walking? The mind might be saying, I wonder what they're having for lunch. They're not used to vegetarian dishes. I wonder how they're made out. I hope it tastes like something. Or whatever. But who thinks of walking? So when we're hoping it's going to taste like something, or what they're going to do with the vegetarian meals and all that, there is unrest inside. It's not a big deal, it's not a tragedy or anything like that, but it's not peaceful. But if we watch every step getting to the dining room, it's very peaceful. There's nothing to disturb it. What is there to disturb a step? So we make step, 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 and the mind and the body stay in the same place. There is this New Age mistaken view that mind and body are one. They're not, of course. The mind is the one that has the intention and the body is the one that's trying to follow it. But they're dependent upon each other, which is a totally different matter from being one. They're two, but they're dependent on each other. And people have made up some sort of fantasy that they've got to be one. Yes, they should be in the same place at the same time. If we take a step, we should be there with the mind too, taking the step. So this mindfulness of the body outside of meditation is just as important as the mindfulness in the meditation, because if we allow the mind to roam wherever it likes, it's very difficult to become concentrated. But if we keep it in check and keep it where we should keep it, it's much easier to sit down and meditate. But not only that, it's a matter of purification and it's learning to be in the here and now. And most people people, if not everybody, lives in the past and the future. And living in the past or living in the future is not really being alive. It's memory and it's projection. So if we have a fairly good memory, we bring up things from the past. And I know numbers of people who bring up unpleasant memories constantly. And then they need a therapist to tell it to. And that the therapist doesn't take their memory away either. He just listens to what they're remembering. And the going idea about that is very interesting, actually. The going idea about that whole thing is that you've got to have it clear, all these unfortunate, unpleasant memories, you have to have them all brought up to the present and work them out so that then you can get rid of them. The Buddha would have been quite amazed at such a statement. You get rid of them if you drop them. That's the only way you get rid of them. And the reason why people keep bringing up these unpleasant memories, and there are a lot of dukkha for people, is because they have an ego support system in them. Look at me, how I have suffered. And it hasn't even been my fault. It's always somebody else's fault, naturally. It's nobody's fault, but this look at me, how I've suffered, and it's not even my fault, is a very strong ego support system. It is actually very often stronger than, look what a nice life I've had. People don't usually do that at all. They're very capable of bringing up these unpleasant memories and blaming somebody for them. Or for the deed that created the unpleasantness, and don't actually bring up all the nice things that happened to them. So if we must live in the past, why don't we bring up the things which are conducive to joy? It seems that most people find that very difficult. It's interesting, isn't it? And it's no use living in the past anyway. There is one thing to be said about memory, and I mentioned that last night, and I'll repeat it now. We can take a good look at what we are doing each day, and then if there's anything that we find that is better left undone, well, not to do it again. And there we're learning from the past. But to learn from a past which is 10, 20 years back, which people do try to bring up, or 5 years back, or 2 years back, or whatever, is futile. And the person who lived through that experience is no longer alive. We are totally different. So if we use this just the day that just happened, we have a chance. It's useful. Useful to see, yep, there's something there that I don't really want to do again. It takes a great deal of self-understanding and self-inquiry to see that the unpleasantness which happens to us is strictly due to the unpleasantness which we ourselves emanate. Not easy. We always like to find somebody who's done it to us. But it's useless, totally useless. Do we have any jurisdiction over somebody else? How they feel, how they see us, how they react to us, how they speak? Do we have any jurisdiction over them? Can we hit them over the head and say, I don't like this, do it differently? It's useless, isn't it? And yet in our minds we do it all the time. There's always somebody who's doing something to us. We call it the victim mentality. We are nobody's victim. We are our own victim. We are the victim of our greed, hate, and delusion. And we don't have to be. This victim mentality is very demoralizing. extremely demoralizing, because you're looking to the outside world for some relief, looking to the people outside for relief. Well, who's interested in giving relief? Everybody needs it themselves. Everybody wants it for their own. Nobody's interested in giving anybody else relief. Polite, friendly, say that don't get irked about anything, but relief is only inside of us. So we can actually, what we do with mindfulness, we have the path of purification there, because when we watch what the body is doing, we don't get hung up on the past and the future. And if we don't get hung up on the past or the future, we learn to live in the now. And when we learn to live in the now, we've taken an enormous step. The only time we can live. Now. I said yesterday, get one of those digital clocks, or watch one of those digital clocks. It's amazing how fast every moment disappears. I don't have a digital clock, but my son has one, so I've been watching it. And they just disappear. Every moment goes. And as every moment goes, if we have thought of the next one, or the one before that, we haven't lived that moment. It's lost. Most people lose most of their lives that way, in the past and in the future. In the future of what they want to become, and in the past, what they would have liked to have had and didn't have. This is the most common. What they would have liked to have had and didn't have. Like their mother wasn't loving enough or something like that. And in the future, they're going to be somebody important. They're going to have more knowledge. They're going to be an excellent meditator. Whatever it is that they're thinking about in the future. But they lose, the people who do that constantly, lose their life doing that. Because the life is happening now. And all they're doing is remembering and projecting, hoping and being disappointed. Disappointed about the past, hoping for a better future. So if we learn through mindfulness, and mindfulness can only happen now, we can't have mindfulness in the past. The breath which is gone is gone. We can't watch it. The step that we've done is done. We can't watch it anymore. And we can't have mindfulness in the future, because the breath that is yet to come hasn't come, and the step that is yet to come hasn't come. So we've got to be on it now. So if we learn to be in the here and now, we're learning a most important thing. And if we do it consecutively for several moments, doesn't have to be a long time, just for several moments, we should be able to notice the relief and release that it provides. It's like losing a burden. There's nothing in the whole world that can actually have any connection to unpleasantness within us, to reaction within us, to wanting something. We're just there. We are being instead of hoping to be or having been. We are. It makes all the difference in the world. That's why mindfulness always takes pride of place. So to be in the here and now. Now with the body, we have two things that happen. They are actually the one and the same, but we can divide it into two, makes it a little easier. One is the voluntary action, like I'm now going to put my shoes on. Or I'm going to dinner. So we have the voluntary, the intentional, I would say. That's better than voluntary. The intentional action. We have made up our mind to do something and we're doing it. But then we also have movements which are involuntary. We don't notice them. We move our hands, we move our heads, we move the body language. that you too are mindfulness objects, those movements. And when we do watch them and become a keen observer, our movements become more exact, and we don't make so many unnecessary ones, which is also a way of conserving energy, physical energy, even though we think we might have lots of it. Everybody does have a limited amount of energy. So we do make a lot of movements which are not productive. So we can learn to watch those. That doesn't mean that we become stiff as a board or anything like that. It just means that we try to use our body in the best possible way. And when we are mindful of the body and watch the intentions, watch also the involuntary movements, it follows automatically that we don't forget, that we know what we're doing, and that we are really concentrated even on the smallest details. And this is an interesting aspect of mindfulness and of spiritual mindfulness: attention to small detail. If we don't attend to the small details within us, the big ones won't follow. We have to find even the small and tiny bits of hate and greed. And when we do, it's a relief. See, one of the things also that people do wrong is that they see in themselves all of a sudden some unpleasant characteristics. And they get very unhappy about that. That, oh, I didn't know I had so much hate, I didn't know I had so much greed, I didn't know I wasn't mindful enough, or whatever. And they get very unhappy about it. And they think of themselves in a negative way. But that's totally wrong. They should be very happy about it, that they found it, because they've got it. So, and they've had it all the time. But now, having found it, is a cause for great happiness, because we can only change what we are aware of. So if we actually find something that needs change, it's a cause for joy. And if somebody else has been the trigger for that, we very often get angry at that person because they made us aware of our own unfortunate reaction. We should be immensely grateful to that person. What a wonderful person. I finally found out how I'm reacting. I mean, the person was probably very unpleasant. And so our immediate reaction is, I don't like that person at all, terrible person. But we should be grateful. We should bend our knees in gratitude. Say, it's marvelous. He was so unpleasant. Now I know all about my reactions. And then, only then, we can change. So the mindfulness of the body, which takes pride of place and should always be come back to outside of meditation, of course, we let go of it when some strong thought or emotion is within us. And we'll talk about those factors of those foundations of mindfulness tomorrow, because we have four foundations of mindfulness. But also, as we become more and more aware of the body, we see it in a different way. Now, we watch how the mind has said, put on your shoes. And we don't take it for granted that the body is putting on shoes. We know that the mind has said, put on shoes. Well, the mind has said, come to this meditation retreat. And so the body sits here. If the mind hadn't said, come here, the body couldn't make it. It's impossible. So we watch that and we see, that's interesting. Mind gives the orders, body follows. The first step of insight. Without it, we'll never keep our meditation going, because we're too body-orientated. Practically everybody is quite body orientated, and the mind is taken for granted. But actually, it's quite a wrong way of looking at it. The mind does all the ordering about, and the body tries to follow. Now, if the body is healthy and young, it can usually follow the orders. If it isn't healthy or is old, it can't follow all the orders. But it's the mind that sets the pace. So that's another very important thing that we learn with the mindfulness of the body. But then, having seen that, there comes also a new way of seeing the body. Namely, so far, up to then, most people would have considered the body is me. And we don't find it so terribly difficult to let go of that. If we can watch the impermanent nature of everything that is part of the body. Now the breath, each movement. If, for instance, we were having movements that are not impermanent, what would happen? We'd turn into a stone, wouldn't we? And we couldn't possibly continue living. All our movements have to be impermanent. A breath, obviously, we'd be dead if we didn't have an impermanent breath. Heartbeat, blood circulation, everything has to be impermanent. And yet, we look at it in a different way. I like to compare that to a meandering brook. Now, you see the brook is moving along, and it's quite pretty. And then you want to get a hold of it. So you put your hand in it and try to grab it. And what do you get? Nothing but a wet hand. You can't possibly grab any of it. It just keeps moving along. Now, if you were absolutely determined to make it stop, you don't want it to move along anymore, the brook. Make it stop. So what do you get? A stagnant pool. You don't have a brook anymore. It's the same with a human being. If you stop it from moving, what do you have? A corpse. That's all you get. And yet, people live constantly as if everything were solid. Everything were the way it is now. And yet it's constantly moving. Constantly changing. So if you see that change in your movements, that change in your breath, if you watch that and remember maybe the simile of the meandering brook, you will see the body correctly. Now if you see that, you might also forget about, or let go of rather, the idea this is me, and get more the idea, oh, the mind must be me. Or if you've gone through that one, then you're stuck with the observer is me. Well, but what does that do about the body for you? It's just with the body. It usually makes people think, okay, I'm not the body, but I certainly own this thing. Now there you can also investigate. If you really own this body, why does it so often do things that you'd rather have it not do? If you were a true owner, why don't you have any real jurisdiction over it? It gets older and uglier. It gets sick when you want it to be well. It's tired when you want to be awake. It's hungry when you have no time to eat. It gets exhausted, and you really don't want to be exhausted. You get a cold and you're sniffling, or you've got a backache, or you've got knee aches, or why does it do all these things? Well, you don't want it to do that. So if you really owned it, why haven't you got any jurisdiction over the thing? Where's the owner? So this is another way of having a look. at our mistaken view of the body. Having another look at the idea we have. Who says, where is it being said that there's an owner sitting inside? How did we get that idea? And maybe we can come up with the reply. It's just an idea. But mostly people come up with, well, it's got to be mine, because nobody else is going to claim it, so it's got to be mine. But again, why? Where, who says that it can't actually belong to anybody? Can't we just see it as a body? A body consisting of many bits and pieces, consisting of the primary four elements, or the four great elements, which all materiality consists of. And if we try to do that, and we'll try to do that in a contemplation just now, we get a far more objective view of this body. And as we get a more objective view of it, it's not so much me, it's a body. A lot of our concern about its size and shape and beauty or non-beauty and its age and its looks and its health disappear. It's just a body. That doesn't mean that we don't look after it. It's the house we live in. We look after the houses we live in. But we don't think that all the things that are in that house are necessarily us. I mean, we don't think that we are the refrigerator, do we? And yet the refrigerator is inside my house. And I try to keep it clean, don't I? And defrost it when necessary. But it's just a refrigerator. Well, it's the same as this body. The refrigerator consists of many different parts, and it's very useful, especially in this climate. You've got to have it. Well, so is this body, consisting of many different parts, very useful, carries the mind around. But it has all its malfunctions and its functions, just like any refrigerator has. And since we never think I am a refrigerator, because of course a refrigerator hasn't got a mind, by the same token, why do we think that this could possibly be me, or even mine? Now with a refrigerator, we think it's mine because we've paid for it. But basically, even if we live in a place where the furniture is provided, we think it's mine because we use it. It's the same with the body. We think it's mine because we use it. But these are all ideas. They have no real basis in fact. And this is something which is necessary, where we need the words to be used in a way which is different from what they usually denote. Look at the words and see, what do they mean? Could it be possible that this is just something I'm using, this body? Now, you know that we speak about the rebirth, and obviously a totally different body is reborn. So there we've got a totally different refrigerator, because the old one wore out. You know, we had to get a new one. The old one just had to be junked. That's the same with the body. The old one had to be junked, was no longer functional, so there's a new one. And again we think, ah, it's me. And we go through the whole misery again and again, and worry about it, are concerned with it, and want it to function perfectly. Nobody's ever had, by the way, a perfectly functioning body, although some people claim that they've heard of it. There's no such thing. Perfection can only be in the mind. And that's only for an arahant, an enlightened one. Perfection in the body is an impossibility. Simply also because of the fact that it needs constant refurbishing. It needs food, and it needs drink, and it has to digest and excrete. So it has to go in and out. So look at that too. That's part of body mindfulness. Doesn't mean that we don't look after the body. It doesn't mean that we are disgusted with it, nothing of the sort. It means that we have a more neutral stand towards it and aren't so adamant about our ownership of it, but recognize the fact that we use it, but not own it. When we think we own it, we of course immensely concerned with it. I mean, like, you know, wanting it beautiful and perfect. But if we think we're using it, we can be a little more relaxed about it. And if we realize that it has nothing to do with me, but that it's just the body, we also don't have to be so afraid of its sickness and disease and old age. But just the way every functioning manifestation goes, whether it's a car or a refrigerator or a body. So mindfulness can extend to other materiality, like, for instance, trees and bushes, even cars and houses. If you look at a house carefully as a keen observer, you will see that here and there it needs paint, here and there it's got cracks, here and there it's got has been banged, trees in the same way. And eventually, if nobody repairs the things, and trees have to repair themselves mostly, their function stops. And they have to go to the compost heap if they are natural items, or they have to go to the junk heap. And it's exactly the same with us. No difference. And yet we think this is me, and this is mine, and we're so concerned with it. And that concern translates into greed and hate. Wanting to have, and also wanting to get rid of. The less we can be concerned with that, the more we can let go of wanting and not wanting. One of the things which can help us in that respect, and all of that belongs to the mindfulness of the body, and you can practice any of them, all of them, one of them, whatever you like. These are all suggestions. They are not hard and fast rules. The Buddha never made hard and fast rules. He always said, well, this is the way it would be useful to do it, and you can try. One of the things which is very helpful in order to get a different slant on this body is a meditation on the four great elements, or rather the contemplation on it. Now, when we speak about contemplation, we are actually speaking about a way into insight. Contemplation is geared towards insight. Now, the word itself is being used in different ways in different traditions, but in this, in the Buddhist tradition, or specifically in this one, contemplation means an observation of universal laws as they apply to myself. In other words, taking the universe into myself, making the macrocosm work for the microcosm. Seeing what is true everywhere, and seeing how I personally also have that truth within me. Now that's a contemplation. A contemplation is not personal problem solving. People love to do that in contemplation. They've just had their lover depart and they're going to solve that in contemplation. It doesn't work. Because what is the lover departing? of nothing but impermanence. So if they were to contemplate impermanence, it might work. But it certainly doesn't work for you to contemplate your lover departing. So, which happens all the time. Or they've had some, the doctor told them that they have some sickness, and now they're contemplating how they're going to get out of it. That doesn't work either. What works is when you contemplate that all manifestations, all existence is dukkha. That works. And then see the dukkha in oneself. So contemplation is the universal situation translated into the personal. How does it affect me? What does it mean to me? Now, obviously, in contemplation, we have the same problem that we have in meditation. We need to remain concentrated on the one subject. And if the mind wanders off, we have to gently and lovingly bring it back. We should never scold it that it does such things, because everybody's mind does things like that. But we should be determined about it. We could treat it as we would and educate it, like we would educate a small child that's intelligent enough to understand what we're saying. Saying, look, this doesn't work, do it differently. But if we scold the child, we don't have much chance of making a big impression. So it's much better to do it lovingly, again and again and again. Patience and perseverance. These two P's are most important in meditation. Patience and perseverance. Without them, nothing happens. And patience and perseverance are sort of like, in spite of setbacks and in spite of possible confrontations with that what one doesn't like, one just keeps on with it. And eventually, it all falls into place. It all works out in a way where there's peace. So we can do a contemplation right now on the elements, but I suggest that before we do, that you might like to stand up and stretch your legs. In order to start, we'll put the attention on the breath for just a few moments. Now I'd like you to feel in your body all those parts that are solid and that you can easily recognize. And the solidity you can feel sitting, touching the pillow, touching the floor, hands on the body, any hardness that you can feel. You can feel skin, hair, anything at all. You can go through the body and feel all those points. We can feel solidity and hardness, compactness. You can feel the compactness of the body. You might feel the compactness altogether or in different spots. All that is the earth element. Earth element has as its characteristic solidity and compactness. And as its function, it has foundation. Now, as you feel the solidity and compactness of this body, you can also feel the solidity and compactness of the cushion you're sitting on. Now let the feeling of the body flow into that cushion, so that the two compactnesses, the two earth elements, merge. And then let it flow into the legs, from the legs into the floor, so that all this compactness merges, that there's only one earth element, not separated from another. And as you feel this merging, move your mind to the side of the house, touch the wall of the house, and let the earth element of the house merge into the earth element of the hand. Both have solidity and compactness, hardness. And now we'll go outside. And the feet touch the earth. And our feeling of earth element within us flows into the earth element that we stand on. We're not separate from it. We can see and feel quite clearly that it's the same solidity that we feel within. And then we walk on it and put our hand on a tree. And again we can feel the compactness and solidity, the earth element of the tree, flowing together into the earth element that we have in our hand. And from there merges with our whole body. So we have it merging from the feet and the ground on up, all the way through the body, to the hand, to the tree. Earth element of tree, earth element of earth, and we continue the same. And now we'll go and walk on the grass and feel our feet and the grass merging together. And the same with the bushes, flowers, small plants and large plants, wherever we go, whatever we touch, we feel the earth element within us and the earth element in nature around us. We look up at the sky, and as we see the clouds, we can tell that the clouds also contain earth elements, because they are visible and manifested. And so we allow the earth element within us to merge with the earth element in the clouds. And now we gently move back with our feet through the grass and the undergrowth back to the side of the house. Wherever we touch the door or the handle on the door, we can feel the solid compactness of the earth element merging into our own. We walk along the floor, feel it in our feet. Sit down on the pillow and feel it in the earth element of the pillow and our seat. And feel the earth element all through the body, the solid, compact aspect of the body. Now we take a look at the fire element within us, the temperature that we feel in our body. The fire element is the temperature as characteristic and destroyer as function, but also rejuvenator. Without the fire element, we wouldn't be able to digest. Without the fire element, we wouldn't age. It destroys, but also rejuvenates, as we know from the forest. So we feel the temperature within us, from head to toe, and then we feel the temperature of what we're sitting on and let one flow into the other, not being separate. And as we walk outside, we let the temperature off the floor flow into the soles of our feet. And the temperature of the door or the handle flow into our hands and emerge. And then as we come outside, we can feel the temperature of the earth itself. And we can connect that to the temperature on our feet, and as we stand in the sun, we can feel the temperature within us rising, and we can also, through touch, feel the temperature of the ground around us rising. We go to the tree as we touch it, we can feel its temperature. Maybe cool or warm, but the temperature of the tree merges into the temperature of our hand, and the temperature of the ground merges into the temperature of our feet. And we are no longer separated. Single entity, but connected. As we walk over the grass, we can feel a different temperature, and that different temperature is also then in the soles of our feet. And it may be also the body, and we merge with that. And then we go into the shade and can notice that the temperature of our body and the temperature of the ground around us diminishes, gets less. And again, we can feel the togetherness. Go to a little stream and dip our hands in and feel the temperature of the stream affecting the temperature of our hands and then affecting the temperature of the whole body. And now we think of ourselves as going into the ocean. And we can feel how the temperature of the water in the ocean affects the temperature in our whole body. And we allow the temperature of ourselves and the temperature of the water to merge. And now we gently walk back to our sitting pillow, becoming aware of the different temperatures in sun and shade as they affect the ground and ourselves, as we can merge into them. We do not have to be an outside observer, but have the feeling of unity. And as we sit back on our pillow, we feel the temperature within us from head to toe, joined to the temperature on the pillow. And we become aware of the water element. Now the water element within us is all that's liquid. Its characteristic is liquidity. Its function is adherence. which means that if you put water into flour, it sticks together and makes dough. So we have adherence because we consist of almost 80% water, which gives us the optical illusion of a separate entity. We feel the saliva, perspiration, the eyes, if we can become aware of the blood pulsating, and we certainly can become aware of adherence. All our parts being together. This togetherness is also apparent in the pillow we sit on, and we let ourselves merge into that. It's apparent in all physical manifestations, such as the floor, the wall, the door handle. And as we go outside, we can feel the water element in the grass, the juice or the dew, and let it merge into the soles of our feet. And as we put our hands on the tree, we can feel the sap. And the sap merges into our hands and through our body to the feet on the grass. And we come to a small stream. And as we dip our hands into that, the water element of the stream is obvious. And it actually adheres to our hands and arms. We're covered with it. It influences us. Makes us cooler. And certainly wet. And we try to merge our own water element with the water element of the stream. As we come out, we stand in the rain and we merge with that water element. As we look up into the sky, we can see that the clouds are filled with that water element. So we connect our own water element, 80% of us, with the water element in the clouds. No separation, no separate entities. Unity of manifestation. And we go to the ocean and dive under a big wave. And we can feel the merging of this body with the water in the ocean. we lose the separation.